Welcome to part two of Inside the Issue, the future role of cell mods in the management of multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Paul Richardson from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and in a part one of this program, he reviewed the biology, pharmacology, and initial efficacy findings with both iberdomide and mezigdomide. And to begin part two of the conversation, he commented on the soon-to-be-presented findings from the Phase 3 Excalibur RRMM trial evaluating treatment of relapsed refractory disease with iberdomide, daratumumab, and dexamethasone, which was the subject of a recent press release announcing that the study has positive results.
The leader of this study, as my colleague Dr. Sagalonio, has been a privilege to work with him and our other co-investigators on this study together. It's a unique, inferentially designed, seamless two-stage confirmatory phase three study. And really what I like about it so much, and I like it about all the other studies we've done with the cell mods as well, is that we've tried to really listen to our FDA partners, brought on board dose optimization, brought on board inclusion of American patients, a very important point, Neil, to show the audience. Participation of American patients is absolutely vital now to approval, as it should be, but especially now. And ideally also be enriched for participation from our African-American patients in particular. So this study had this two-stage design where essentially you began with a straightforward efficacy and safety assessment of iberdomide combined with daratumumab and dexamethasone, and then this comparative study after dose optimization had been confirmed where iber-dara-dex was compared to the gold standard of dara-bortezomib and dex, DVD for short. And so you had iber-dara-D compared to dara-VD, and these patients had to have received one or two prior lines of therapy, and they had to be lenalidomide exposed and or refractory, but obviously could not be dara-exposed and dara-refractory. So in that context, this began in June of 2022 as the pandemic sort of settled down. The enrollment has actually now been completed. And importantly, the initial results based on an MRD endpoint apparently met their primary endpoint, although obviously we're blinded to the actual data itself, so I can't give you absolute numbers. They've not been reported and or presented. But this press release was entirely reasonable because it basically said we've made our primary endpoint. And it's a planned interim analysis that was done, and that MRD endpoint was met. So the results from these are in ongoing discussion with the FDA, and I believe the plan is that as data matures and basically we're able to see a clinical benefit outcome milestones met, there will then be a position for the regulators and the sponsor to sit down and make the information more readily available to the community in anticipation, hopefully, I would hope, of an approval. Because at the end of the day, we've got a statistically significant improvement. We know that for MRD. We know that MRD matters. It correlates with clinical benefit. And in this setting, the one thing that it has got to be shown is that it's meeting an unmet medical need. That is an important point. And I would argue the tolerability of iberdomide and the importance of an all-oral approach and the setting of communities, and particularly vulnerable communities, there is this unmet medical need. So I'm very hopeful as you put that all together, Neil, that we'll see iberdomide approved in the near to medium term. And hopefully we don't have to wait too long for it to be available for our patients.
So the FDA just issued a really interesting statement. Sounds like they're endorsing the use of MRD, minimal residual disease, as a acceptable endpoint in clinical trials looking for approval of new agents. I know MRD is kind of a surrogate for PFS and OS, but I'm also interested in how you actually look at MRD. Is it just positive or negative, or are there different levels of positivity?
Yeah, it's a fabulous question, Neil. It's a complex question because actually MRD, one has to be patient with, I think, on the one hand, and recognize the heterogeneity of disease. And obviously that MRD behaves differently under the effect of different treatments. So I think MRD is an excellent correlate for PFS and also has been shown to correlate with OS. I think it's particularly robust in newly diagnosed patients in the sort of induction remission phase, intensification, and maintenance. I think MRD can be very reliable in those settings. I always would say, though, that MRD can vary in terms of its importance in the individual patient, so one has to bear that in mind. But putting that to one side, in the relapse refractory setting, it's equally important in my view, especially as a surrogate for benefit in trials such as Excalibur. So I think its reliability in that setting has been established across multiple trials and, of course, led to FDA approval as an endpoint in its use using adaptive technologies and others, basically meaning that we've now got a very important new tool with which to assess the efficacy of our new drugs, as well as our established agents and treatment approaches. So all good news, in my opinion. I think that the differences in relapse refractory disease that we're looking for are obviously not the same as the differences we see in newly diagnosed patients, where MRD rates are very high, no matter what you do, and the differences between one approach versus another may be relatively subtle, one might suggest. I mean, and of course, durability of MRD is very important. I think in the relapse refractory setting, we've been struck that the differences are more pronounced. You know, for example, a very good platform, and in my experience, pomalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, or PVD for short, widely used across the globe, you know, is a good workhorse regimen in relapse refractory disease. It was the basis of the Optimism study published some years ago and approved ex-US, actually. And the only reason it didn't have formal approval in the US itself is because of some commercial aspects and patent-related issues that, you know, changed that algorithm on the sponsor's part, not the regulator's side. Anyway, a very well-established combination approach. At the end of the day, MRD rates with that approach can be as low as 5 to 10%. And similarly for Dara-BD, which is a great regimen in my experience, a control arm of many important studies, and FDA approved, as well as European marketing approval or medicines agency approval, you can see that these are very important established control arms. Their MRD rates can be quite modest as well. Even for Dara-BD can be quite modest, not perhaps as low as we see with PVD, but slightly higher, but still modest. And what we then see coming in with these regimens from the phase two experiences is MRD rates that may be significantly higher. And these results from Excalibur suggest that it's probably, you know, well, clearly it's met its endpoint. That's the nature of the press release. And whilst I obviously don't know, I would imagine that this reflects a substantial increase on baseline MRD rates achieved with control. That being the case, it means the likelihood of clinical benefit being superior for the combination of iberdomide, daratumumab, and dexamethasone, in my opinion, is likely to be high. So I'm very encouraged by these results, Neil. I think they will hopefully reflect a platform for approval in the relatively near future.
And just to clarify, these patients were IMiD refractory and had also previously received anti-CD38?
No, they could not have had prior. They could not be refractory to CD38 for obvious reasons, because they were assigned to DARA-containing arms on both sides, right? DARA-BD versus either DARA-D. That's an important caveat. But they had to be lenalidomide exposed and or refractory, and they had to obviously had prior proteasome exposure typically, but they couldn't be classically refractory to bortezomib, so that they could then be assigned with equipoise to the Dara-BD arm. They could, of course, be bortezomib exposed. So I think at the same time, this is a very important phase three experience with Excalibur, but if one looks to the kind of real world phase threes in the space for the cell mods, I really do think Successor 1 and Successor 2, you know, stand as excellent phase three studies in this setting. And we're very hopeful we'll have some very powerful results from Successor 2 as early as this year. And Successor 1 hopefully will not be too far behind.
That actually brings us to our next topic, which is Successor 1 and Successor 2. Can you describe the background, the rationale and design, and maybe what you're thinking we're going to see here?
Thank you, Neil. Well, let's start with Successor 1 simply by virtue of our order. This is basically a two-stage randomized study that basically compares the combination of mezigdomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone with pomalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, which I just talked about earlier as a globally widely used regimen. And so essentially, the pomvel-dex acts as a control. Then if we look at the actual mezi-VD combination, there was a nice run-in which was designed to optimize dose. Again, this really does reflect excellent advice and guidance from the FDA. And then the dose is selected, and then we move into the selected dose with bortezomib and dex. In this case, mezigdomide at 1 milligram, 3 weeks on and 1 week off, was the best dose. Bortezomib was given in the standard fashion, and pomvel-dex was given also in the standard fashion. And the key primary endpoint is progression-free survival for Successor 1. And then secondary endpoints include overall response rate, obviously overall survival, which in my opinion is very important, safety, complete response rate, MRD negativity rate. And then I think critical for our patients and something that needs to be emphasized is health-related quality of life. And then basically that, I think, is vital as we go forward. Now, as we think about Successor 2, it's similar, but the important point to understand is there was this dose optimization phase in stage 1, where we looked at 1 milligram of mezigdomide, 0.6, and then 0.3, and then optimized dose. And here we landed again at this excellent dose of mezigdomide at 1 milligram, 3 weeks on and 1 week off, combined with carfilzomib. And I particularly like the design of this trial because it was randomized to a 3-to-2 randomization. So three patients got mezigdomide KD, and two patients would get KD. Now, KD, we felt, had equipoise because it's a highly active regimen, and the Endeavor trial had suggested that it could result in median progression-free survivals that would be in excess of 18 months to 2 years or more. And so, therefore, this was a reasonable equipoise compared to Mezi-KD. And obviously, this was a large part of the trial, almost 400 patients strong, after the first part of the trial, in which there had been a randomization with dose optimization to ensure that we retained a control, which would help with the FDA's assessment of the benefit of mezigdomide, but at the same time, dose optimized. So really some sophistication to this trial in terms of its design. But again, the primary endpoint, progression-free survival, and then other secondary endpoints, as I just touched on. Now, what's really interesting in terms of eligibility, though, is that these patients not only had to be lenalidomide exposed and or refractory, but they had to be CD38 exposed and or refractory. This was really important. So these patients were CD38 exposed and or refractory and len refractory. And obviously they had to be tolerant of carfilzomib and not refractory to it in order to come into the study. So this basically completed its enrollment robustly at the end of last year. And at this point going forward, we basically ended up with a very robust early completion of enrollment, and looking forward now to getting preliminary results, hopefully as early as sometime later this year, hopefully around the summer, if not a little bit later.
So it seems that the initial phase 3 data we're going to get on both of these agents is going to be in relapsed disease. If both are approved, both studies are positive, how are you going to decide when and which one to use?
Well, it's a great question, Neil. I think of iberdomide as an ideal drug up front and as a maintenance agent, for the reasons we talked about earlier, not least of which this much lower risk of second primary, which I think is vital as we think about a strategic view of myeloma. And it's just so well tolerated in my experience as well. However, this approval will mean it's available to clinicians in early relapse, and I think that's a very good thing. Mezigdomide, to my mind, will be meeting a very important unmet medical need, and that is essentially in these heavily pretreated relapsed refractory patients. Obviously, the studies are designed to give us maximum flexibility. You know, we're looking at patients in first relapse. I think that's totally warranted because, you know, let's face it, Neil, now our first relapse patients are quadruplet exposed. So in a sense, they're what we used to consider line two or three of old. They're now line one. So having mezigdomide available in first relapse is an advantage in my view. I think the important point, though, is that mezigdomide is there to really help around BCMA-exposed patients, extramedullary disease, all the sort of real challenges that we face in the clinic once our BCMA-targeting approaches and others, such as GPRC5D, have unfortunately failed our patients. When that happens, we need drugs like Mezi, and we need drugs like Ibrin, arguably, to help some of these other strategies work better. So I'm very hopeful we'll have a broad opportunity to deploy the CELMoDs across the relapsed refractory space, and clinicians will have the choices that they need to really improve patient outcome.
I want to go on to a paper actually from the ASH meeting, the EMN26 trial. Can you talk a little bit about what this study is actually looking at and what we know at this point about this really interesting strategy that I think you kind of alluded to, but maybe you can talk a little bit about EMN26, the phase 2 study.
I think it's a brilliant study. I think the most important takeaway for our audience is that iberdomide was basically compared across cross-trial comparisons with lenalidomide and shown to have a markedly higher rate of improvement in response, over 70% by cycle 12, whereas, for example, for the lenalidomide in comparable settings, there was about a 30% improvement in response at cycle 12. So this really kind of, I think, embodies why iberdomide is so exciting as a maintenance drug and as a drug for induction remission therapy. And basically, conversion to MRD negativity was strikingly high. So this, I think, bodes so well for Iber as a mainstay of maintenance therapy. I mean, as we recognize, lenalidomide is a great drug for maintenance, but all of us know that patients going on longer than 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years run into a variety of difficulties with it. And iberdomide, fortunately, doesn't seem to have that. So I think this is clearly a more effective platform, and surprisingly less toxicity, including actually, very importantly, less GI side effects. So I think that in itself is very exciting.
So I assume there's a phase 3 study going on?
Right. A whole number of efforts are underway in the context of iberdomide maintenance and induction remission therapy. I do want to touch on our own work being led by my colleague Clifton Moe. Determination 2 is built on an all-iberdomide induction remission and maintenance strategy combined with the CD38 monoclonal antibody isatuximab. So basically, it's iber, bortezomib, dexamethasone, isatuximab, induction remission therapy. And for standard risk MRD negative patients, there's harvesting, transplant deferred, and iber ISA maintenance, which I think is a lovely approach because it's so active and so well tolerated. For the patients who are, however, high risk and or MRD positive, this functional assessment of risk therefore moves them to a different space. And there we're testing high-dose melphalan with autologous stem cell rescue against Linvo for a fixed duration of Linvo as our bispecific of choice, followed again by iber and isatuximab maintenance. So a really innovative approach led by Cliff in Determination 2. And we're really looking forward to that trial actually is getting underway as we kind of speak. We've got multiple sites and we're getting active. Hopefully we'll be activated as early as March and we'll be looking forward to enrolling patients. So I think the promise of iber is up front and the maintenance for all the reasons we touched on. And there is, of course, a randomized trial of iber versus lenalidomide in the so-called Excalibur maintenance study. And that's ongoing.
But just to clarify, so the Determination 2 trial is just going to go ahead and use iber as the instead of lenalidomide. Wow.
For those patients who are MRD negative and standard risk, we really feel it's appropriate now to actually defer transplant, keep more toxic or potentially more toxic intensification in reserve. So for that reason, if you're iber, VD, ISA treated, your standard risk and your MRD neg, you move into this maintenance phase, well tolerated, we believe, or will be, and preliminary data from phase 2 studies suggest it will. Just to share with the audience, iber VD ISA has been tested by our Spanish colleagues. It's exquisitely active. The myelosuppression is very manageable. And at the end of the day, this is a very exciting platform, we think, going forward. Interestingly, Neil, if you use iber VD plus DARA, that's also very active. The Mayo group have done this. The snag is because there's 2 months of DARA, the intensively dosed weekly, there appears to be a more myelosuppression with the DARA V IBER D approach. Preliminary data, phase 1-2 study ongoing from Mayo, so we have to be careful. But we haven't seen the same thing with IBER VD ISA, at least amongst our Spanish colleagues, where this platform has been highly successful. So we're launching a phase 2 study, IBER VD ISA, led by my colleague, Dr. Weixin Liu. And we're also launching Determination 2, where we're incorporating iber VD ISA in the way I described. And what's so interesting, Neil, is, you know, FDA have been great. They've taken a long, hard look at the study this time, actually in the fall of last year, and given us the green light to proceed. And they've done the same thing for iber VD ISA as well in the single-arm phase 2 trial. So FDA are very, very kindly and fully on board with this, and we're very excited by that. And we're about to launch this study. It is actually an investigator-sponsored trial, Neil. It's the largest independent support of an investigator-sponsored trial in terms of its funding. In other words, not from companies, but from philanthropy. And we're really looking forward to delivering best drugs with a special effort to community access, and in particular to our African-American communities. That is a defined goal of the study.
If I understood you correctly, it sounds like Determination 2 has a bunch of patients standard risk or just not going to transplant. And right. I guess my question is, so my question, of course, you know, follows Determination 1 data, but is that actually what's happening in the community and at transplant centers?
Yeah, it's increasingly being seen. Let me explain why, Neil. Determination showed with a triplet followed by transplant versus delayed transplants, overall survival stayed remarkably similar, despite a major PFS gain in favor of early transplant. Now, that raises several questions. The most important one is there competing risk? In other words, if you're helping some people but hurting others, does that explain why the overall survival becomes the same? Well, it seems to be more complex than just that. It's not only that there is competing risk. Some patients seem to benefit more from transplant, and others clearly do not. We see that in mutational burden at relapse, for example, in their disease being much higher after high-dose melphalan. So that's a clue. The second thing is there are some patients who clearly don't get much more benefit from high-dose melphalan than if you simply treat them with induction remission therapy. And then finally, there are the second cancer risks, AML, MDS in particular, to early melphalan use. So there are a variety of factors. And then I guess the most important point is that we now have multiple excellent salvage options which can be offered to our patients that can basically make equivalent the overall survival. So good news is there are choices. The real game changer, though, has been the MIDAS trial. The MIDAS trial came from our French partners, and it was designed to show that melphalan would move the MRD needle meaningfully in both assigned treatment arms of the study. One was single transplant versus just quadruplet therapy. The other one was single transplant versus two transplants in higher risk MRD positive disease. Unfortunately, high-dose melphalan moved the needle in neither arm. And as a result of that, there's been a real embrace now that actually high-dose melphalan, where it clearly has its role, it may not be mandatory for every transplant-eligible patient at all, and that, in fact, we have choices for our patients. And I think that's an important step forward. The New England Journal paper of MIDAS was published last July, and I don't know if you saw it, Neil, but we also published an editorial, myself, Dan Longo, and Nikhil Munshi, where we basically tried to make sense of the MIDAS data in the context of determination and other important transplant trials to frame for clinicians that one size doesn't fit all, that transplant clearly has a role for some patients, but not everyone. And obviously determination too reflects the next step to try and further understand who gets the most from transplant, who gets the most from a bispecific, and who can be spared both, at least initially.
One final topic here I'd like to talk a little bit about. It sounds like, at least with iberdomide, the future is upfront and a maintenance. Is that mainly what the trials are looking? Okay. So what I'd like you to, as a final topic, I'd like you to talk a little bit about ongoing trials of Mezi and where you see that landing.
Super question, Neil. So Mezi, I think, is increasingly being studied as a combination agent with existing and new platforms in relapsed refractory disease. There's IBA being tested also with bispecifics, for example, and as maintenance strategies after BCMA targeting therapy. I think Mezi is being more aggressively pursued in this highly refractory population because that's where we think its role could be very, very successful. I think one of the most important things is that it's not immune exhausting. It's the opposite. It actually enhances the immune system. It gets it back up to where it needs to be. That's so important because obviously immune exhaustion is what we're seeing as you sequentially use immunotherapies. Highly active as they may be, they run out of gas. I mean, that's clearly what we're seeing in an important number of patients. Whilst obviously some have wonderful responses, others unfortunately can see these responses be very short-lived. So mezigdomide may have a very important role in enhancing that. But I think what's also very clear to us is if you combine mezigdomide with other strategies, you can sequence and syncopate therapeutic paradigms to optimize outcome. This is very important. We presented an abstract at ASH. My colleague, Dr. Clifton Moe, is the first author. It's the combination of mezigdomide and selinexor. And what we saw that was so interesting, number one, we saw excellent responses in highly refractory patients, including patients in whom CAR-T had failed them, unfortunately. But what was particularly fascinating is we saw an extraordinary effect on T-cell subsets. There was really an enrichment of immune activity by virtue of enhancing T-cell number and function in a positive direction. And that's tremendously important, Neil, because we're struggling to look for options to on-ramp patients to their next CAR-T. We're struggling to look for safe options to do a variety of things in the advanced setting. And a combination such as mezigdomide and selinexor with dexamethasone, all oral, generally well-tolerated because you can use much lower doses of selinexor to do this, generally well-tolerated, active, and, I've got one patient, I'll just share one patient, lovely story. He'd been teed up to go for CAR-T. He'd had a pretty intensive therapy before this in which my CAR-T partner, Adam Sperling, said to me, Paul, perhaps you want to give him a little bit of a break here. Let's try something else until we take him to CAR-T. He was highly refractory. We popped him on to mezi-celi. He's had a beautiful response, and he said, gentlemen, with all due respect, can I just defer the CAR-T for now? I'm going to carry on with mezi-celi because it's achieved a complete response and he's doing extremely well. He's been on therapy for a couple of years now. So you can see how, we're using these strategies both to delay moving to more intensive immunotherapies, but also to enhance them.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Richardson, and thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Neil Love for Inside the Issue.